Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which is live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. We are broadcasting at davidrovics.com/quarantine on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as via my channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. You can find all of these discussions archived on my YouTube channel in the Discussions with David playlist and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform or go to davidrovics.com. The main problem with today's guest is he has way too many areas of expertise, all of which are on subjects that I am fascinated by. You can be sure we're going to have Matt back for further discussions, and you can also be sure that there are going to be a lot of topics left over for many future episodes. Matt Callahan was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. He was raised by radicals and artists, and he became a radical and an artist himself at a very young age, though the names of the organizations changed, as did the music. Matt was on the ground floor of the cultural and political explosion of the 1960s and 70s in San Francisco, and he has been touring, recording, producing, engineering, writing powerful, timeless songs about history and current events, and in more recent decades, writing some fantastic books as well, including two of the most seminal books about music and radical thought, The Trouble with Music and The Explosion of Deferred Dreams, both on PM Press. He also published two songbooks on PM Press, which double as some of the most engaging history books you might ever read. Matt Callahan, welcome to my little live stream show.
Thanks, David. Thanks for inviting me.
First of all, in the current very strange historical moment in the world now, how are you doing in Switzerland there? And how thoroughly has your economy collapsed and what's going on? And you don't have any viruses?
Personally, we're fine. Yvonne mm-hmm. and I, my partner, haven't been sick or anything like that. The situation is calmer than it appears to be in the United States. The virus certainly struck here, and in particular the Italian part of Switzerland. It's adjacent to Italy, where the first really big outbreak in Europe occurred, and that obviously spurred the Swiss government to react because it was literally adjacent, and there were workers coming into Switzerland every day anyway. I mean, that's the norm, including mm-hmm. healthcare providers. So they had to do something. They couldn't not react, and they organized bailouts for the public, as well as the big banks and whatever, as well as starting a lockdown and enforcing physical distancing, which just yesterday was loosened for the first time. The curve, as they call it, has pretty substantially declined, so the containment of the virus has been effective up to this point. There's still a lot of debate, of course, about how extensive they should allow the return to so-called normal. I'm of the opinion, and I know a lot of medical people are, that they should go very slowly, if at all. And this urge to get back to work is pointless in many ways. There are obviously questions such as kids going to school and all of that sort of thing that need to be addressed. And I think they're doing okay, from what I've been hearing from parents. My daughter is in Berlin, and the Germans are more or less doing the same thing, and my grandkids have to go back to school now. So there are some things seem to be, I would say, sensible and reasonable under the circumstances. Other things are being debated, but it's definitely the climate is very different than it is in England, for example, or the United States, where there's this sort of panic and madness that's clearly coming from the government. These are political problems, not medical problems, or they're political problems that are compounded by the medical problems, however you want to formulate it.
It seems like, I mean, it's we both spend a lot of time on both sides of the Atlantic, and I think that perspective is an interesting one, because I think there's a lot of people here in the United States who maybe haven't traveled that much, or they don't have much, they're not paying that much attention to what's going on outside of the United States, and they think that this is just how it is, you know, with this situation, that, you know, that actually, you know, it's just going to be, you know, sort of everybody for themselves, and panic, and if we can't work, then we're going to starve, and there are no other options, and like it's just doesn't seem to even enter into the minds of many people in this country, for understandable historical reasons, that that the government is actually there to do anything useful, like help in a situation like this. Right. But in Europe, it's the default assumption that the government is now going to step in and do something useful, and they are in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. That's true. And I think obviously the historical differences are what, you know, are relevant here. It's not just that they're actually decent people, quite the contrary. They're in many cases, the politicians in Germany, Switzerland, whatever, are right-wing bastards as far as I'm concerned. But they're nonetheless forced by the situation, the historical situation, and the duties that the average European thinks belong to the government, that if they want to maintain any kind of hold on the situation, they have to respond. Part of that you could attribute to social democracy, the histories of the previous two world wars, all the things that have gone in, the revolutions that have taken place in Europe. And in fact, that's ultimately what the more or less rational response of some of the governments have been. They're a result of these struggles, actually.
Right. Isn't it true? And I wonder, I mean, one of the things I keep thinking about just in terms of history and in terms of European history is the 1840s. Like, and I mean, because that was a period although it wasn't a global, blight. It was a pan-European crop failure that in many ways is a bit reminiscent to a global pandemic or to a pandemic of some kind, like epidemic or whatever. It's like this natural sort of this phenomenon related to human civilization, but it is also basically a natural phenomenon that you then need to deal with as a society. And when in the 1840s, of course, every monarchy in Europe, save for Russia and Britain, was overthrown by popular rebellions, at least for a few months, right? And that's the kind of history that it seems like actually Europeans, many European leaders actually are still aware of that history. Like which here it seems like even the Depression is like ancient history that people don't even, you know, but although the state is acting so much faster than they did during the Depression, right? It took, I mean, in the U.S. and during the Depression, it took years before the state actually implemented any kind of like helpful policies to stop starvation from happening, right? But things are moving much faster now. I wonder, just can you expand on, I know you're one of the most knowledgeable history people I know, and I wonder if you could just expand on some of those precedents that they keep on saying are unprecedented.
Well, first of all, it's clear that there's many precedents for pandemics. I mean, thousands of years ago, they were recording epidemics in Athens that, you know, brought down governments and so on and so forth. So it's definitely not a new phenomenon at all. I think that the experiences you're referring to, you know, going all the way back to the bubonic plague and all of the things that actually transformed the political and human landscape of Europe as well as other parts of the world, certainly those things resonate because there are still buildings, there are still actual physical objects that one can see and tourists visit that mark those tremendous moments. In recent years, of course, there the wars, you know, certainly World War I and World War II did much more devastating damage in Europe than did in the United States. You know, I mean, this is a big factor in both, you know, you might say popular memory or what people lived through and are still alive today to recall. And that has a, you know, obviously has a real bearing on political decisions that are made by various parties, whether they're right wing or liberal or social democratic or whatever. I think that the problem of historical amnesia, which you're addressing, which seems to be, you know, almost emblematic of the United States or the American cultural landscape, is still pretty widespread. I mean, you know, I don't think Europe is some kind of like living museum of intelligence or something like that.
And especially when it comes to knowledge of American history, just to interrupt momentarily. I mean, in Europe, like, I'm constantly running into people who have never heard of, say, the industrial workers of the world, or are unaware that there is a history of militant labor unions in the United States, which there right. certainly are, you know, which right. is, yeah.
But no, that's true. And I was referring more to the fact that a lot of young people today here in Switzerland, or for that matter, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, are also cut off from their history. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not like here everybody knows everything. The past is living, and so on and so forth. I mean, because ultimately the same both technological, you know, the media in general operates in similar fashion, and the other thing is that, of course, the what everybody calls globalization, imperialism by another name, has managed to in a certain sense, it's bundled a lot of consumerist thinking into this sort of global leveling of cultural or historical difference. The truth is still there, and the history is still there, but it's definitely been able to obscure things here in Europe, similarly to the United States. Now, where it differs, coming back to the question of how governments have actually reacted, I think that the differences are much more political than they are scientific. In other words, the science is the same, and if you you speak to doctors in the United States, and you speak to doctors in Wuhan, or you speak to doctors in Italy or wherever, many will agree. There's a broad consensus about epidemiological questions, virology, and so on and so forth. So that's not really the problem. The obstacle is clearly at the state level and the level at which the actions are coordinated or not. And we've seen some egregious behavior on the part of governments here in Europe. So I don't think they should be allowed to get off the hook. I mean, the fact is that, you know, when you compare the reaction of the German government to the Italians' plight, you have a nationalistic divide. They're supposed to be in the EU. It's supposed to be the United States of Europe or something like that. But they wouldn't allow masks and supplies to be sent between each country. It was the Cubans.
The Cubans, yeah.
Doctors sent to 50 countries or 60 countries in the world that showed the way. This is the way. This is the international solidarity that a pandemic not only implies, but should be reacted by. And the same goes for the Chinese in trying to provide masks and things like that. They sent a lot of things to various European countries. And I think that the main lesson or the main point is not lost on many people here. It exposed the scandalous attitude of many of the politicians throughout the continent, not in any particular country. They'd be saying one thing and actually, you know, doing some good things in terms of like guaranteeing people's income, freezing rents and stuff like that. But at the same time, they're mouthing nationalistic, we have to look after Germans first. So you have this mixed bag of ideological structures. And meanwhile, of course, they're not doing the right thing in the sense of stopping all sanctions, you know, helping the Iranians, which is what the popular will would have them do, but they won't, because they don't want to break the link that they have with the United States and things like that. So the political things are very contradictory, let's put it that way. The contradictions are now the interesting thing that's new and perhaps is better seen in Europe than the United States. I don't know. I can't speak for that because I'm not there. But the what's happening has sort of come into full view. So everything I'm saying now is known by, I would say, the vast majority of Swiss people.
It's basically like so many contradictions within so many societies have been just starkly exposed, and that, exactly, that applies to Switzerland as well. And also one of the things that it seems like is being exposed in so many different countries is aside from all those other things is just the basic competence of governments, whether they, like here, I think the government, municipal, state, and federal government mainly seems to exist to sort of set up structures to steal from the population in one form or another, or to exploit the population. And it's not really set up for actual, you know, governing in the sense of like helping people or right, programs that can be quickly implemented that are useful, whereas in many other countries in Asia and in Europe, governments are actually capable of governing in the sense that people think governments are supposed to govern. Like, you know, here we can't even suspend the rents or the mortgages, so we have a crisis, an imminent crisis of who knows what kind of scale. It's
right. Well, have to about what I consider to be common knowledge, or you know, that this has been exposed to average person. It truly is, what I'm saying is not radical at all.
Yeah,
you know, it's not lunatic fringe stuff. But that's another difficulty I think that you have in the States, which is less so. I won't say it does not exist, but it's less so. Is this you know, this, there is a lunatic fringe, and there are people that are spouting all kinds of snake oil nonsense, smoke and mirrors, hokum. And of course, that's as old as the country, you know, the medicine show. I mean, this is America.
Yeah.
And American people need to disabuse themselves of the notion that that's somehow, you know, in the public interest because it's free speech, or that it's humorous, or that it's somehow kind of hee-haw TV or something. I mean, this is not funny.
No.
And these kinds of ideas, you know, which of course proliferate through social media, you know, have to be combated. You have to be able to approach a pandemic for what it actually is. And sure, there are debatable points. There's a lot to be learned. I'm not advocating that people should simply unquestionably follow what the medical establishment says, but there are scientific principles that can be understood. They can be conveyed to the general public. They are not incomprehensible. I'm not a doctor, but I can understand the basic principles, and I can understand why physical distancing is necessary. I can also understand why vaccines are helpful in most cases. I also can understand that this is the public good, that we are a species. We are not a, you know, bunch of different races. You know, all of these divisions are utterly meaningless to the virus. They don't matter.
On that note, though, Matt, I wonder if you know, given that I was reading recently about the polio epidemic in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and there, despite the fact that a lot of governments in the world were aware that social distancing and taking the kinds of measures that are being taken now and that were taken in 1918 would have been a good idea, many governments did not take such measures and just allowed polio to run rampant in the population in New York, for example. And I wonder, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball to be able to really answer this question, but I wonder if China had not sort of set this example, you know, of locking down society, do you think that it would have been done to such an extent, or even at all, by European or other countries? I mean, I wonder. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have to assume that it would, simply because there's the evidence has been mounting for almost two decades. You know, it depends, right, on where you want to start the process, but certainly you can argue that it goes back AIDS, you know, in the 80s, and the discovery, the length of time it took to actually discover the what it was, and then to develop medications that combat it, and so on and so forth. But even if you just start in the 21st century with the discovery of the avian flu and SARS and all, I'm sure you've heard this and other guests have said it, so I don't want to belabor the point. But the point is that there is a growing body of knowledge that has developed through the course of these successive epidemics that, I mean, for example, just one thing that I happened to read on the state television's, you know, statement, it's actually on my computer, but nevertheless, it's broadcast by the Swiss government, was they actually frankly admitted that at the outset, they didn't want to do this, but mm-hmm. the medical establishment, the leading epidemiologists said, you will have blood on your hands.
Yeah. Right.
You know, they said, you cannot get away with this.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was actually publicly stated that the government originally wanted to put business first, not public health. And there were sections of the medical establishment, I mean, leading doctors who have been empowered by the state to give advice to the government, who said, this is the advice. And if you don't take it, you're committing a crime. So, and that, again, I'm not making this up. I read this on the government's own. It was worded slightly differently, but that's essentially what it was saying. So to answer your question, I don't know if they really had an alternative. You know, I mean, I think that there have been different reactions. Sweden didn't do the same thing. They didn't lock down. They, you know, and so forth. There are of the policies you know, picked from or chosen from, but the overall policy, the overall worldwide reaction of which has led to all the planes being on the ground and so on and so forth. I think that's partly a response led by not only the Chinese, but the South Koreans, the Singaporeans and so on, who all reacted and got immediate proof in the sense of results that this was the right course of action if you want to conquer the disease. And on the other hand, the fact that it spread worldwide so rapidly was, you know, indisputable evidence that it had to be a worldwide response. And again, I think that the crucial thing from my point of view, now I'm not speaking as a medical person or anything, just as an artist and author, I look at it from the point of view of the opportunities that it presents. I look at it from the standpoint of the future and not the past. Yeah. Because from my perspective, the immediate questions that had seemed so far away, to begin with public health and the fact that the medical you know, what it means to treat the public, the masses of people, the population, whatever words you want to describe, comes first. And that should be an ongoing and simply normal thing. And that there should be no private pharma, there should be no big private firms vying for public money just so that they can find a vaccine and make money from charging for it later. I mean, this whole thing is so absurd. The whole setup is so absurd that the common person realizes this is no way for the future.
Yeah, and of course, here with so many people not being able to afford healthcare and so many more barely able to afford housing or not able to afford housing, there's a lot of these things are being questioned, which maybe were being questioned by a lot of people before, but suddenly the level of desperation seems to bring about some kind of possibility of maybe a paradigm shift here. I mean, maybe like even politicians who are running on a platform of a rent freeze now seem conservative, you know, because a rent freeze, what's that? That's useless. That's nothing. You know, we need to cut the rent in half. We need to do away with the whole concept of rent. We need to have actual affordable housing. We need the government getting involved here. I mean, there's it's a whole different ball game, potentially. I wonder if it will be. I don't know. But my landlord has just raised the rent here. So I wonder, you know, it's like with these financial corporations, these investment companies that are sort of running the housing market, it's so removed from any human sort of any kind of human like involvement. It seems like, I wonder where things are going to go if the system just kind of keeps on going until the fact that the capitalists were able to shut down their own societies like this really surprised me. And because it's so against their whole MO. But of course, if they didn't do that, then they'd have all kinds of other economic consequences to suffer from. So they were aware of this conundrum.
Yeah, well, I think that raises a second point regarding the future, and that is that the climate situation was at a crisis point before this. And suddenly we have all the planes on the ground, oil is worthless, and you say, well, isn't this the perfect opportunity? Let's get rid of fossil fuel all at once, right now. Don't tell me you can't do it. You just did it. And it's like, this is the kind of thinking that a very short time ago would make you part of the radical left.
Exactly. Even, the anti-austerity, the dreamers.
Even in Europe.
Yeah.
Where
impractical. Impractical, you know, radical left.
This
right?
is simple. All the excuses, the reopening of giant coal burning plants in Germany, all of this stuff was just happening 2 months ago. Now, the question of why can't we go forward and get rid of this thing forever? Boom. That's the second thing. The third thing, which in terms of the future, that this raises, and it came up very recently in the United Nations, was the end of war. And that means very practical steps. You know, you stop allowing weapons to be manufactured anymore of any kind. You get all the foreign troops out of any foreign country, return home. You stop the sanctions against Iran or whomever the United States has sanctions against. The idea that was raised in the United Nations was a world ceasefire. Okay, that's a good starting point. The only country that voted against it was the United States. But the world wants that. The world wants a ceasefire. The German people want the United States to get its nuclear weapons out of Germany. Right?
Yeah.
So what I'm talking about is not radical at all. This is exactly what people are now saying. That's what we should do. It's time to end the militarism. Why are we spending trillions on weapons when we should be funding public health? How can you say we have the money for this when you don't have the money for that? So the point is that here you and I, two radicals talking, preaching to the choir. What's the point? The point is that the choir is now largely expanded.
Yeah.
It's enormous. The world is listening. And the thing is that would have happened anyway. And that's the important thing to remember. So that when you talk about the capitalist reaction, they knew this was coming. And when you read documents that they write to each other, and the things that I recently read a report that was prepared for some, you know, big think tank, Brookings Institute or whatever, about the age of protest and the fact that in 2019 there was an explosion of protest all over the world.
Yeah.
And some of these were on the verge of revolutionary kinds of government overthrow type things, such as Lebanon, such as Chile, and so on. And the point is that was already happening. So this simply, it was an accelerator. It was not, it did not create the situation, but it accelerated these crises and the confrontation between the public interest and the private interest, in the sense the private being big corporations. I'm not talking about your toothbrush. I'm talking about the concept of the private ownership of the means of production of everything, which is enshrined in virtually every constitution in the world, you know, and this is what has to be confronted, and this is what has to be changed. So when people, whether you see it as a total systemic thing or you see it as a set of programmatic issues, such as I just laid out, it amounts to the same thing in the context of fighting this virus. Because if you deal with, you know, public health, you know, make it free and absolutely a human right, something available to all, and that's the duty of governments to provide. You end war and you decommission nuclear weapons and so on and so forth, and you as quickly as possible, switch to sustainable energy. You're talking about a massive revolutionary transformation in society. And the only people opposed to it, the only people opposed to it are a very tiny handful of bankers and oil companies and so on and so forth, who have, you know, perhaps a section of the population that continue to support them. So they have a certain, you know, layer of protection. They're surrounded by a certain military, a certain police force. But when that starts to break down, when people are being asked to go out and shoot their own people because they're demanding public health care, you're going to see a division within the ranks of those forces that protect those rich people.
Exactly.
You're going
right?
to see people like the Venezuelan army standing up for Maduro and not allowing a bunch of mercenaries to come in and destroy their country. You're going to see more of that, where the breakdown of the security system, it won't just be an Edward Snowden or Chelsea Manning. It'll be whole sections,
yeah,
within the military saying no.
Because you have a situation now where obviously it is the families of the military, it is the families of the police who are also getting sick, who are also losing their jobs and losing their places of residence, and this is all a society-wide thing. So once it gets to that level, and of course they also have to breathe the air and live in this world. So although the climate catastrophe could sort of be put off somehow, but here on the West Coast, when they talked about the crisis, it was the crisis. It was a capital C, and we were talking about the housing crisis, the homelessness and near homelessness of so much of the population. And I wonder, I mean, I know this may be switching gears a bit, but you know, it's okay. You grew up in California. You were raised by radicals, and for one thing, and I wonder, just for one, as someone else who was also raised by a left-wing mother, I never really acknowledged, really fully acknowledged her influence on my thinking, and until I was probably late in my 40s. And I wonder, did you figure that out earlier, or did you think you invented radicalism as a teenager, or were you conscious as a kid that you were growing up in this context of a place that was a bit different from much of the country, had this tradition?
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco, which is where I'm from, the city itself, was a very different place than it is now. People who live there now, unless they're my age or have, you know, connections with people who have a historical knowledge of the place, really don't know what San Francisco was like. And
no.
So that's a question in and of itself. That's part of the reason that I wrote the book, The Expression of Deferred Dreams, was so that young people today could get a sense of what was actually happening in this mythological era, which has been completely distorted in most accounts. The media accounts of San Francisco in the 60s are largely false. But there was something important that was happening at that time that really can be cherished and learned from and upheld as a high point in the struggle for liberation. So in that sense, to answer your question, I was aware that I was in a special situation, but I didn't feel isolated. You know, for example, my parents were actually in the Communist Party, and they went through the McCarthy era. You know, my father was underground because they were jailing leaders and so on and so forth. So, you know, there was an atmosphere of being, you know, careful and, you know, knowing that you're not, well, I'm talking about when I was a kid, that, you know, an atmosphere of, you got to be careful what you say. The phones are all tapped. You know, I grew up in that kind of a climate, which of course is not normal. I knew that. But at the same time, you know, my father's in the Longshoremen's Union. You know, there are mass, you know, parades on, you know, up Market Street with the longshoremen and being their, you know, the longshoremen's fife and drum corps, or what it was called, you know, and you know, there were powerful forces within the city politically powerful forces that were opposed to the status quo and defended workers and so on and so forth. So you didn't feel, that's what I meant by not feeling isolated, that it was.
Right.
And then, of course, by the time I was old enough to be drafted and, you know, confront the Vietnam War that way, because I didn't want to go to the, I didn't want to fight in Vietnam. And that was something I shared with my whole generation, you know, that was not, certainly was not confined to me.
Yeah.
By that time, there had been such opposition to the war within the military, you know, people were mutinying, fragging their officers and opposing the war within the military by the time I was drafted, because I was born in 51. And so my number came up in 1970. And the point being that in that situation, the sense of a global uprising, the sense of this, a revolution is coming now or imminent.
It was really pervasive.
That is what I attribute to my own radicalization. In other words, my parents certainly played a role in it. The situation in San Francisco played a role in it, all of that. But ultimately, I wasn't even political in the sense that I am now or you are. I was just going along with the flow. I was a musician, right. You know. Taking acid, smoking pot, doing what my generation got famous for. Okay. But when the draft came, I had to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to decide, am I going to the army? Am I going to Canada or am I going to jail? Those were your choices.
That's a big decision.
Right. And as it turned out, it's a long story, but I mean, basically I told the government they could come and get me. And at that point, they had created a new classification called 1H. And that 1H classification meant that you were deemed fit for service in a national emergency, but would not be called at this time.
Because they didn't want radicals organizing within the ranks of the military.
I found that out later, and I was able to prove that is indeed the reason. But at the time, the policy of the United States Army in particular was that they wanted to bring radicals and troublemakers into the army. We're going to make a man out of you, son.
Mm.
And we're going to discipline you into obedience.
But they had too much real experience with the Black Panther exactly. Party that changed their perspective.
It didn't work. And by 1968, they were already changing draft policies, and specifically the draft boards in Berkeley and San Francisco. And this I found out, you know, going through research records and whatever, and interviewing some people. So, I mean, I'm not just blowing smoke here. This is actually documented that they made a policy decision. And because originally there had been a classification called 1Y, but it was open-ended. If you got 1Y, you were off the hook, but you could be called anytime. I mean, really, until you were 62 or something. It was just open-ended. So you had a bunch of young men who were really in a bind. They couldn't get jobs. They couldn't plan their life because they, on the one hand, they weren't being called in the military, but on the other hand, they were on hold. So they changed the 1Y classification to 1H, which meant you were on the hook for a year. And at that point, if you hadn't been called, you were, you know. But the reason was, and this was not publicly stated, but again, I found the evidence for it. The reason was they didn't want any troublemakers. And I had announced myself to be a troublemaker. So unbeknownst to me, that's what got me out.
Yeah. Well
done. Let's put it clearly. That did not get me out. What got me out was the courage and the intelligence of people in the military who were fighting back. That's what got me out.
That's what got you out. That they were afraid you'd join their ranks.
Those guys and women who were demonstrating, fighting, risking their lives, not just against the Vietnamese, but against their own government. Those are the people who got me out.
You know, one of the things, you know, I lived for many years on and off in Berkeley as well as in San Francisco in the 80s and early 90s. And I have been fascinated with the whole history of San Francisco for a long time. And I almost, when your book came out, when Explosion of Deferred Dreams came out, I I probably wasn't going to read it, except that I was reviewing it for, I think it was Fifth Estate. And I'm so glad I read it, because I learned so much in there that I had no idea about. And one of the things, if I were to sort of, I mean, encapsulate one of the things that from that book that I got so much out of, and I don't know how we can even approach this subject in the time we have here, but I just want to paint this little picture. I mean, I always grew up with the media telling me that in San Francisco, to the extent that they ever mentioned the 60s and the early 70s and the social movements of the period, which of course they've generally totally avoided in my youth growing up. Anything I learned about that stuff did not come from television, you know, but to the extent that TV ever talked about these things back when I was growing up in the late 70s and the 80s, it was always like everything's put in boxes. There was the hippies. They were totally apolitical, doing their drugs. And then there was the radicals, and they were doing this. And then there was the Black Panthers, and that was a whole different thing. And there was like no connection between all these things, no crossover. No, it wasn't like a movement that had any kind of cohesion. It was just a whole bunch of freaks doing all kinds of weird stuff. And one of the pictures that you paint in the book is not to gloss over the divisions or the differences and the distinctions in various parts of different social movements, but to such a huge extent, there was a lot of cohesion, a lot of connection, and there's a movie, I don't know if you've seen this documentary about the Grateful Dead traveling across Canada. It's called Something Express. It's like they were traveling by train across Canada and doing shows all along the way. Mm-hmm. Festival Express, I think it's called. I enjoyed the movie. I mean, I like the Dead, right? So, mm-hmm. I also just learned that you opened for them with the Looters one time. But as they're traveling across Canada, everywhere they're going, they're getting protested because they're playing shows where there's an entry being charged. And then they deal with that by putting on lots of free shows where there's no entry, which is really pissing off the people organizing the shows where there is an entry, but they feel so compelled that they have to do this. And they feel so bad about doing these shows where there's an entry charge. And as I'm watching this documentary in 2000, whatever, I'm just thinking, oh my goodness, what planet are we on? Why do they feel so bad about doing shows where they are charging an entry? I mean, it was like totally mysterious to me. And they didn't try to explain it in the movie either. They just made the protesters seem totally bizarre. But reading your book was the first time in my life, at the age of whatever it was when I read it, just a few years ago, 50 or so, that I really understood that this was a profoundly political vision involved with the whole music scene, which sort of driven by bands that everybody has heard of, like Jefferson Airplane and Creedence Clearwater Revival, and the, you know, all these, especially the Airplane. But I wonder, just, I don't know, I'm not, I don't have a particular question, but can you just talk about that atmosphere, that how would you even explain it? I mean, obviously, I can tell people to read your book, but if you're trying to explain in a few minutes how that atmosphere came about, and what was the idea between around having these big events that had to be free?
Well, first of all, just in a nutshell, all this began in a certain sense by a interesting combination of events. First one being the San Francisco Mime Troupe was performing in the parks of San Francisco, doing radical theater, and they were first of all opening this space for performance. They were gathering large audiences, and that was part of what was happening. Okay,
and you were in their band too. They formed a band
later. It was later actually, but they, you know, that was in 1970. But in any case, this was in, we're talking about 1964, 65 in this period. And then simultaneously, you had the Family Dog, a melange of basically radicals, left-wing radicals who'd been part of the free speech movement, the peace movement, you know, the burgeoning anti-war movement, who decided they wanted to put on dance concerts, which was a rather novel concept at the time. You had really no place where young people could go people under 21, because that's the drinking age, to listen to rock and roll, and let alone dance to it. So, you know, this is hard for people to grasp now, but I mean, these things were not legal. You know, you couldn't drink. The only place where music was played was in nightclubs, where you had to be 21 to go hear it, or in coffee houses, which were, you know, did not allow loud music like rock and roll and so on. So in a nutshell, there were these two, you know, streams that were sort of pouring into each other. And what ended up happening as a result of that was the Family Dog had a very successful event at the Longshoremen's Hall, and the Mime Troupe's leader, director at that time, Ron Davis, was arrested in the park. And the Mime Troupe decided that in order to raise money for their defense, that they were going to have an appeal. It was called The Appeal. And the appeal included the Jefferson Airplane, Allen Ginsberg, a bunch of poets and whatever. And it was at their warehouse. They probably expected a couple hundred people to come and pay a couple dollars to get in, and they would raise some money. But as it turned out, a huge crowd showed up. And Bill Graham, who was their business manager, recognized the potential and wanted to have another appeal. They did, in fact, have another appeal. And he found his place, the Fillmore Auditorium, which still exists, and to my knowledge still has shows, although I think it's now run by Clear Channel or Live Nation or some other big corporate entity. In any case, that is how the whole thing started. The Family Dog then went on to do shows at the Avalon Ballroom, and the Fillmore continued under Bill Graham's direction. And the result was that you had these situations where there was very low ticket prices, there was no alcohol, so kids could go in and listen to music, right? This is unprecedented. And at the same time, because the Mime Troupe had opened up the parks to these theatrical performances, bands started to come down and play. And it was quasi-legal. You know, the sound ordinances had not been put into place in such a way that they could bar people coming out on a you know, sunny Sunday and plug into a generator in somebody's house that was, you know, or some get power from somewhere and do it. So for a few years, there were these regular free concerts in the park, and the Grateful Dead was one of the many bands that, you know, effectively built their audience by playing at these events. And that is why when they went on tour in Canada, and it wasn't only Canada, it was other parts of the states where they not only felt compelled, in other words, I don't think they were really forced. I think they really believed it. You know, I mean, give them credit. You know, it's like they were not, quote, political in any sense of the word. They weren't political the way, say, Country Joe and the Fish were.
But they were part of the milieu.
But they
were
part of what was happening, and they knew that there was something more important than money. They knew that there was something more important than fame, even, that music had the power to pull people together, draw them together in a celebration of life, a reincarnation of the festival in the classic antique sense of the festival, which is a universal phenomenon in the world. All societies have festival where the public gathers to celebrate itself, and the audience is itself. The audience determines what is the fair. You know, it's not a promoter, it's not a ticket price, it's not a rock star, it's the people themselves. And that's what festival is, whether it's a religious rite or, you know, a seasonal the harvest season, whatever. I mean, this is part of our, you know, cultural legacy. And the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, all these groups understood that. And you know, they were aware. They could see it before their very eyes. They may not have theorized it the way I'm talking about it now, but they certainly got it. I mean, that was part of the day-to-day conversation. And in this case, I can rely on my own experience because I was there. I participated in this. So for me, it was already a betrayal in 1973 when Bill Graham started the Days on the Green, the first big stadium concerts that were this was the format that was going to, you know, channel the revolution into, you know, commercial and
capitalism.
Capitalism,
because as you described in the book, what was happening in the late 60s, it was this, it was like a constant buildup. It seemed like there was, it was like every these festivals kept on, these free festivals in Golden Gate Park just kept on getting bigger. Right. I mean, right. It was like this was going somewhere. There was a general idea that this was going somewhere. It wasn't, I don't know if it was clear where it was going, but it was going somewhere, and this was the model for it to go somewhere. It needed to be free and public.
That was what Woodstock was, you know, supposed to be about. On the one end, it started out as a paying concert, and then it became a free concert because they couldn't stop the stampede of people. And Woodstock, which happened in New York, was clearly modeled on you know, what was originally took part in San Francisco. And in fact, about 50% of the bands that played at Woodstock were from San Francisco. Sly and the Family Stone, Santana, Creedence, mm-hmm. The Dead, Airplane, blah, blah, blah. But the point is not, you know, again, it's not like, you know, San Francisco came first. I'm not trying to champion some sort of, you know, local chauvinism here or something. The point is that those events that happened there, were rooted in a particular place and time and had a particular manifestation, which, you know, led a lot of people to, you know, various different things towards music, towards politics, in some cases dropping out, whatever. I mean, it's not like it led to the revolution, but that was the idea. Do you see what I mean?
It led to a whole lot of different thinking and a lot of different practices.
Right, and the important thing to remember is that what Woodstock or the festivals in San Francisco, and I'm sure what the Grateful Dead had in mind, was that somehow music was going to change the world. You know what I mean? Even the guy, Tom Johnston, who from Doobie Brothers wrote the music, listened to the music, he said in an interview that that was our idea. We thought that if we could just bring this music, some the world leaders would all get the message and we could change the world. Okay, it's naive.
But a lot of people were getting the message. I mean, it was part of not necessarily coming like prophets, but they were part of a scene that was communicating an anti-consumerist and anti-militarist message. And there was a lot of squatting going on. I also didn't realize in San Francisco at the time when you were young that there was a whole scene that I was totally unaware of. But
I just think that the important thing to keep in mind is that, going back to your original point about Dead, it's not that they were somehow, I wouldn't want your listeners to get the impression that they were like stampeded by an angry mob. No, they were guilt tripped maybe, but it was their own feeling at that time that we should play free. You know,
I love that. Speaking of guilt trips, I love that story in your book about folks who wanted to buy land in Northern California, and they went to L.A. to guilt trip a band into giving them money to buy their land. Wasn't that in your book that story?
It could maybe be.
Yeah, I know. Once you write a book, you forget some of the details, right. I'm sure. Or maybe it was somewhere else. But I wanted to just, in the little few minutes here, we have, first of all, I want to have you back because we there's at least 50 subjects that I still want to ask you about. But you came out with a fantastic songbook last year, Working Class Heroes, and it's really a history book. You could say a history book masquerading as a songbook, or vice versa, or both, really. But I wonder, I could easily answer this question for myself, but I wonder what your answer is, given that there were already some, I think, very good books that bear some similarities to Working Class Heroes, such as Songs of Work and Protests and Carry It On, which are both books that I, you know, wore out to the point where there's no binding left in either one of them, you know, growing up. But what compelled you to put this songbook together?
Well, there were two specifics or concrete things. One was the election of Trump and this idea that, you know, the white working class was you know, Trump supporters, which I knew to be untrue, but nevertheless thought there had to be a way to combat it by showing the history of the very people that are supposed to be Trump supporters in Kentucky and in the South. That's one thing. And the other thing that we thought was particularly urgent at this time, and this is a much more positive reason, is that a lot of young people that we'd encountered at the Brooklyn Folk Festival and other places were being inspired by old time music, but were unaware of this whole legacy, which some of their heroes like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie certainly were trying to tell them about. But when we discovered this songbook, Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People, which was 50 years old in 2017, we decided to take a selection of those songs to remind young people, look, keep in mind, you might have liked O Brother, Where Art Thou, but here's another version of that song. And this was performed in 1931, or this was performed in 1927, you know, by real people. You know, let's, all these questions of authenticity and, you know, what's real folk, all this other stuff that comes up. It was sort of like, okay, well, here we've got some real people, real Kentucky coal miners singing this stuff. I hate the capitalist system. I mean, come on. Yeah. There's your evidence.
Yeah. And, right. And that's so fairly direct.
Right. And for, you know, who are inspired by the music, inspired by the, the anti-commercial, the aspect of it that's like, we can do it ourselves. We can all play banjos and fiddles. We can all make music together. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. So I just wanted to add that, well, there's this dimension that you should know about. It's not the only one. It's not like everybody in Kentucky was singing those songs, but those songs were part of the history that has been systematically erased. And it should be remembered that this is not, you know, if you want to know your history and you want to know where these songs come from, you should know this part of it too.
And part of the erasure of that history, I mean, there's so many aspects of the sort of erasure of that history that's so intentional on the part of the powers that be. And I just want to maybe just mention one other wonderful book that you wrote called The Trouble with Music, which is a bit older. I guess you wrote that, 2006 or something? Yeah. And that prior to the advent of the music industry, which is basically like what, about 110 years old or so in some form or another?
Well, maybe actually older. It really began in its modern form in 1828 with Jim Crow. The beginnings of the music industry in the United States, and therefore worldwide, I have to add, it with blackface minstrelsy. Wow. It was the beginning of music industry because that was when the model was formed. The you know, there had been a music industry in the sense of selling, sheet music, right, and charging money for attendance at shows. But what we call the music industry, which is pop acts selling records or, you know, celebrities running around, this was really begun with blackface minstrelsy, and it continued from 1828 to 1927 with the jazz singer, the first successful talking movie, which was Al Jolson in blackface. And so this is the story of the music industry, and that's another thing that we're trying to develop with a new project that should be done soon called Songs of Slavery and Emancipation, is to show the complicity of the music industry as a structure, meaning as an enterprise, in the not only the erasure of what people were actually doing or spontaneously arising from amongst the populace, but its replacement. They replaced what was coming from the people with something else. And in the case of blackface minstrelsy, it's obvious that it was this degrading image of black people. It was part of, you know, justifying and defending slavery and profiting from the sale of tickets and sheet music and so on and so forth. But that continued even after slavery was over and it was no longer nice to do blackface anymore. It continued in other forms.
In other forms, right?
Yeah. You know, it was very specifically directed towards white Southerners, and the segregation of white and black music was deliberate and quite clearly, created. In other words, black and white people live side by side. It's not a question of they each loved each other and were just divided by the man, but they heard each other's music and their music was constantly cross-pollinating and constantly influencing each other. But when Ralph Peer came down to Bristol, Tennessee in 1927, looking for acts to put on Victrolas, right? He began the process of segregating white and black.
Right.
And that became systematic. So there's a great book called Segregating Sounds, which is recent. It came out in 2011, I believe, that documents this in great detail. So it's, again, it's not something I'm making up. I have to emphasize that this is so counter the prevailing notions, even amongst radicals, about right. where popular music
brings people together
from.
And all this. Yeah.
Right. Or the fact that, well, you know, the music industry really, they're kind of like neutral, you know, they give right. the people what no. they want. That's not
they are
true.
Leading the charge in dividing society by race.
They have created the obstacles yeah. to real popular music being developed.
Right. And real popular music.
Meaning the music that comes from the populace.
I think you called them anti-music at some point in your book, too.
Yeah, well, I was in trouble with music. I tried yeah. to go into the whole, but that's a whole subject in itself.
Yeah, and that is if I can get you on again, I want to spend the entire hour just talking about the trouble with music, and we'll only get up to the 1920s, I imagine. But yeah, Matt okay, Callahan, no thank you so much for joining me on my.
Well,
little program
you,
here.
A pleasure. Always yeah. a pleasure, and keep it up.
Yeah, you too. I'll see you again.
Okay.
Take Bye-bye. Care, Matt. Thank you. And thanks, everybody out there, for tuning in to this discussion with Switzerland-based musician and author Matt Callahan. You look him up on pmpress.org. PM Press has put out most of his recent stuff has been put out on PM Press books, songbooks, recordings. Tomorrow, I'll be talking with Portland-based journalist from Beit Zahor, Palestine, Saad Banura. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and eventually back out on the streets. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through.